up, what up, doggies? This is the Little Steps Podcast, and I'm Rekha Shankar. Today, we're sitting in with Andy Beckerman. He was a writer for The Pete Holmes Show, has written for AdultSwim.com. He has his own podcast called Snap Impression with Ramsey S., another person we interviewed on the Little Steps Podcast. Awesome, cool dudes. And Andy and I basically sit down, talk philosophy, talk life. It is very fucking chill. So, hope you enjoy. Yeah, we hooking back up. And when they bang this in the club, baby,
you got to get up. Bug niggas, drug dealers, yeah, they giving it up. Awesome. So, hi, guys. I'm sitting here with Andy Beckerman. How are you, Andy?
Hey. You just... For Rekha, did I say your name right?
It's Rekha, actually. Rekha. See, mother, guys, fudge. Do you see, though? We just met. You can see. We just met. It's beautiful.
That's also, like, a trigger for me, is mispronouncing people's names.
Oh, yeah?
Because I feel like... If you have, like, a non-standard name, mm-hmm. and even that I'm a little iffy saying, but
like
let's
non-white.
Just say, let's just go with, no, I don't even mean that. I just mean, like, you know, like Hari Kondabolu, I know how to say it. So I don't even mean that. I just mean some name I've never said before. How's that?
There you go.
And I know that you've probably had to correct people.
Sure, yeah.
Hundreds, if not thousands of times at this point. So I like that immediately, like my empathy sensors go off.
Sure.
And I just immediately plunge into a kind of, like shame. It's definitely shame. And like feeling bad that I've, now there's another, you now have another in a long line of incidents where you're like, no, that's, thank you for trying, but that's not my name.
Here's what I'll say to that. I'll say that the mispronunciation doesn't really get to me. It's when people misspell it in emails when I've already sent them an email. That happens so often.
I don't know what to say. I can't. I can try to put myself in their feet, and that they just weren't paying attention and just like were rattling off. Maybe they're on the subway and they're just rattling off an email while while the Wi-Fi is working.
Yeah, it's funny. Mm. It doesn't bother me that much, but if I had to choose, that's definitely more annoying. I actually keep an email thread where I just copy and paste to my one really good friend every time it happens with no context. And it started happening in like multimedia sort of ways. Like someone sent me an Evite that had that. It was so funny. It was like this cross dissolve of my name onto the Evite. It smelled wrong. So I had to like take a screen grab of it and send her.
Anyway, what I was saying though was that you suddenly saw like go me from like a medium kind of tone to we're recording. Oh, here we go. I'm now animated, or I'm at least trying to put energy into it. I'm reversing entropy.
You got it. You got it. There's tons of energy. I feel it. It's good. Don't even worry.
Oh, I'm not worried. I'm just saying. You, if you had some surprise, if there was some kind of like, oh, what's going on here?
Got it. Yeah. Well, I was alarmed. Almost canceled.
Again, my empathy sensors. My empathy sensors going off. Going like, oh, you just there's a change of energy in the room.
Yes.
Like a hairpin turn kind of change. And so I'm putting you at ease.
Thank you. And actually, speaking of which, I feel like that's a very good. That's a very good tactic to have when interviewing people in general, which you are a podcaster.
Yes.
So I actually wanted to start off by just like asking you, like, what does that mean to be a podcaster? Like, what do you, is that, would you consider that like the main thing that you do?
No, I would consider it like, you know, when you're at this stage of your career hustling, I would say it is one of many, I mean, someone can be a pod, like if
For
you're...
Sure.
Well, even like Mark Maron or Scott Aukerman, who I'm sure make a fair amount of their income from podcasting.
Yeah.
They both have TV shows on IFC.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure pays way more than Earwolf or WTF pulls in. Is there anyone? Okay, here's a question. Is there anyone that you think, I'm not challenging you, but I'm just like, is there someone out there, Adam Carolla maybe?
Who's like main thing.
Yeah. I mean, I've never listened to his podcast because from all accounts, he's kind of a racist misogynist.
Yeah.
So I'm not.
You know, I would have actually probably said Maron. Not as like that's his main thing because he's a stand-up and he has a show.
Oh, yeah,
stuff.
It does. So I'm sure.
But, like I like feel like so many people like associate WTF as like the first thing with him. But that might just be my millennial bias of like.
Mm-hmm.
that's how I got exposed to him.
Oh, that's interesting also, yeah. too. Like, because I grew up with him. I remember watching him on Short Attention Span Theater when I was a kid.
Okay, yeah, there you go.
In the 80s.
Yeah.
On Comedy Central or whatever was the thing right before Comedy Central that turned into Comedy Central. So, yeah, I'm not sure. Yes. Who makes their living at podcasting? Let's say Adam Carolla. So, sure. Or maybe Anthony from Opie and Anthony. Who's the one that got fired? Maybe if you're only racist and misogynist.
True. You have to be a podcaster.
Yeah, you have to cultivate a small group that will fervently, like the people that donated, I don't know when this is going up, but the GoFundMe people that just donated to Darren Wilson's defense fund. Oh, you have to cultivate a small racist following that will give you tons of money to support yourself.
Oh my. Yeah, well.
Hey, well. Well. Within 5 minutes, we've already talked about Ferguson. We've already hit the podcast. Yes, so the question was, no, it's like one of the, I started Beginnings with my old writing partner, Mark, a long time ago, because we were writing like really absurd sketches.
Yeah.
And we wanted a form where we could be ourselves.
Yeah.
And also like the original incarnation of Beginnings was something a little bit like this show.
Yeah.
Where it was like, we were baffled by how could someone have a career
in,
because we were just like, we had just moved to the city and we were just like, this seems unbelievably daunting.
Yeah.
And we had just read Mike Sack's book and also Steve Martin's autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And both of Mike Sack's, both of them are wonderful, by the way. So this is not a criticism of them.
Yeah.
But some of the people that they interviewed, that Mike interviewed, or some of Steve Martin's stories just elided all of the steps right in between. And it's just like, oh, so wait, Steve Martin went from playing a coffee house to a stadium.
Yes.
Or, and I could be misremembering his book.
Yeah.
But, and the same thing, like, I forget who it was, but there was someone, like, who wrote jokes down on a napkin, and they were writing on Jack Parr the next day, and it's like, is that really how that happened?
Yeah. And, like, the thing with that, too, I think there's something in a comedian's DNA or something that's supposed to say, like, you can't reveal the trick. Or something, there's like some magic to comedy that you don't want to necessarily go into the steps. Like, I find that Jerry Seinfeld was my idol growing up, and I got irritated when I got older and could watch interviews with him because I wanted to be a comedian so badly. And here is this dude that I admired so much that I felt like couldn't articulate anything except jokes.
Why am I a shell of a person?
Yeah, like, it would
What's empty? What's missing from me?
Yeah, basically.
That was the worst I felt, by the way.
But it doesn't matter. This isn't Snap Impression, all right? But
what happened to my soul to make me like this?
Basically, and it would drive me fucking crazy, and it's so sad, but the thing that actually drove
existentialist Seinfeld.
Yeah, basically. What's it all for?
That's not a bad character.
That's not a bad, I'm sure that's a Twitter. But
it is now.
Yeah, right now.
Copyright
right now. Coming. Yeah.
2014.
But it would bother me so much. And, like, in addition now to his, like, semi-racist shit that he's said, too, it just kind of, like, made me a little disenchanted with him. And, like, I find that's why I started this podcast, because I got really irritated with talking to people that I admired and just kind of seeing, like, oh, I don't know if it's just because you don't explain things well or because you don't want to. But, like, you essentially are saying, you went from doing open mics to doing huge stadium shows. Mm-hmm. Like, how? So I find it really interesting that, the Beginnings podcast, I actually remember I went to, I think you guys did a live taping with Kurt Braunholer.
Yeah, we did. We were at, up until I just feel, sorry, like I'm name dropping.
No.
I got it. A job writing stuff for the Pete Holmes show.
Yeah.
So up until that happened, we had been, and I had to move to LA quickly.
Yeah.
We had been doing it for about 2 years at UCB East.
Okay,
every month.
Cool. I'm going to actually totally backtrack. How did you, so you got the idea for Beginnings when you and your friend just moved to New York.
Yeah, we had been writing, so this is convoluted. Let me just try to shorten it as much as possible. We had been writing together starting in 2003 in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Pittsburgh had no comedy scene. But we had both been in bands, and the band, right after college, my writing partner in the band went to grad school, went to MIT.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of in this, like, existential, can I swear?
Yeah, of course.
I was in this existential shit pit
yes.
of like, what am I going to do? I didn't want to go to more schooling yet. I had studied philosophy, and there's not much else you can do with that besides go on to grad school
yeah.
or become a lawyer.
Yeah.
I applied. I did all the LSAT stuff. I got letters of recommendation. I was going to go to law school, and then I had a panic attack thinking about actually studying law.
Yeah.
Because it's awful.
Yeah.
The minutia to study law. Like, you have to... It seemed like boring to me.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, all right, we're not doing that. And just kind of started this sketch duo called Wrestling Team because yes. we had been fans of Kids in the Hall and Mr. Show and Stranger the Candy and the UCB sketch show, mm-hmm. which I'm sure are all for people that are around our age.
Yeah.
Even though you're much younger than me. All flashpoints for. Anyway. This is getting very long and convoluted.
No, that's what I want.
Okay. So, we had started writing together and filming. We filmed like an 80-minute sketch show. We Whoa. Filmed a 45... Then the second episode of Wrestling Team, which was a 45-minute sketch show. This is like 2003, 2004. I eventually do go off to grad school.
Yeah.
To Temple in Philadelphia to study philosophy because I was going to be a professor. Look, this was the dumb plan. This was... a lot of this story that I say today will be a story tinged with fear and anxiety because what I really had wanted to do, like, since I was in a band, like, was, like, be a performer, perform. Yeah. And I was too scared. I was like, oh, no, that's not a thing you can do.
Mm.
This is something, like, from beginnings that I realized, like, talking to people was that if you don't grow up in New York or L.A., or if you don't grow up with a performer in the family,
yeah.
a lot of people are just like, oh, that's a thing that other people do.
Yeah, that's not a real job.
That's not a real job.
Yeah.
Or that's not a job I can do.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you'd sent me some questions.
Yeah.
I was thinking of them on the way here. I also thought of them before, just, you know.
That's but also great, on the way here.
And I was thinking about how, like, a lot of... this stuff, like a lot of becoming a professional writer or performer, not that I'm really that, but I'm like, you know, in that hazy kind of halfway area.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is like learning how to transform yourself into this like creature that's okay with fear and chaos and living on like a jello-ish ground.
Yeah.
And like, if you can existentially transform yourself into that, that's like what this journey, in quotes, is. Film those two shows. I go off to grad school.
Yeah.
I'm miserable there. And Mark and I are still writing stuff like back and forth. He's in Pittsburgh. I'm in Philly.
So when you filmed those shows mm-hmm. and you knew you were applying to grad school at the same time, right?
Yeah.
What was going through your head then? Just like, I need a safety blanket or I really want to do this or like, what was the motivation behind that?
I loved philosophy.
Yeah.
Like good philosophy. Like most of the discipline is like garbage. Most of the discipline is analytic philosophy. I won't go into why that's terrible. Let me give you, okay, I can just give you this real quick thing.
Yeah.
At a analytic philosophy of film class.
Yeah.
Philosophy of film. Film is amazing. There's so much theory about it. So many ways to like learn how it like integrates into our lives and what it means to create film, how it reflects on the human experience, all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Instead, this class was every week, X is film if and only if, let's say why. And then we would argue about definitions and come up with counterexamples and it was all like meaningless stuff. Like it was like, well, what if we project a still on the wall? Is that a film? It's like who?
That's very like logic based.
Well, that's what it is. That's all of analytic philosophy, which is the dominant form of philosophy in America.
Oh, wow.
There's historical and there's cultural based philosophy.
Yeah.
Also known as continental. Because it comes mostly out of France and Germany.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of problems with that too, but it's meaningful. I think it's, there's something real about it. There's something gripping. There's something that it, actually has to say about what it means to be human. But, it's like few and far between. And even like when I ended up in grad school in a department that had people that did that kind of stuff, it was not a dominant part of the department, and it was not like well respected.
Wow.
Sorry, I lost track of where.
No, so you were saying, I was asking, like, what made you go into grad school?
So I liked philosophy. I did like it, but it was fear, right? It was like, I need a job. You know, if you get a professorship, a lot of people are kind of like if you tell them you're studying philosophy, it's weird. I've gotten fewer kinds of. I don't know what you want to call them. I don't want to say arrogant, but like jokey asshole responses saying like, oh, I do comedy. Then I do saying I did philosophy. Like, philosophy, like, oh, what are you going to do with that degree?
Right.
It's just like, oh, well, you know, you write essays and you get a professorship and it's a fairly lucrative, if you can get a decent professorship, it's a fairly lucrative position. If you get tenure, you're pretty much set as long as you don't, you know, fuck any of your students or anything like that. So it's not like it's not a bad living.
Right.
So I was afraid that I needed like a, I'm sure you've heard this before from other people. Like, I need a job that has a 401k.
Of course, yeah.
And I need just a direct career path.
Yeah.
But I visualized it as like I could see this like open, like a tombstone and an open grave. And you can just see like you're sliding, like you're like, okay, I go to grad school, I get a professorship and I'm just going to get on. It's a muddy, by the way, this like slide that somehow goes in the grave. It's muddy. So you just get on this like toboggan and you slide straight into the grave.
Oh my God.
And there's your life. Like you could see it just like written out before you. And I'm sure I'm sure that's what some people want. Like, I mean, they don't want to die.
No, but like they want to ease, like so smooth path. Like they don't want to rock the boat.
Yeah. They want to know what's coming up and they want to just be able to like, you know, I've worked with like plenty of people at day jobs and things like that. That, I mean, there's plenty of people like, who in showbiz, it's not like showbiz is like this like magical, mystical kind of, I mean, it operates by different rules and what I think sets it apart is that there's a lot more complexity because you have levels, you have way more levels than in a corporate office. I think corporate offices are hierarchical and so you've got a lot of things, they're complex, but I think, you know, like Goldman Sachs or something, a lot of that comes down, like if you want to know why the 2008 crash happened, I think there's a logical story you can tell that operates by a linear logic that says like, well, someone up at the top dictated this and then people followed those rules.
Right.
You know, we're going to, what is the story? We're going to take these derivatives and chop them up into these tranches. Is that the phrase? Or we're going to make collateralized debt obligations and then sell them to suckers. Like, I mean, that's a pretty fairly, you know, it's a complex story that takes someone like Matt Taibbi to explain, but you can understand it. Like showbiz has like, you have agents, managers, you have people at the studio level or at the production company level. You have all these different levels that are complexly interacting with each other to make a product, a TV show or a movie or whatever you're making. And that story is a little more complex because there is a lot of that shrouded. Like if someone's manager puts them, if you're like, why did that person get that role?
Yeah.
A lot of chances are it's like, well, their manager is also a producer on this TV show, and so they put their own clients up for it. I mean, there's a story you can tell.
Yeah.
It just seems like there's a lot more pieces that are moving than, like, say, a job at a corporation.
Right.
Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, no, and in terms of, like, because you were saying that in response to, like, when people kind of scoff at, like, the idea of a philosophy background and say things like, oh, how are you going to get a job in that? It's, like, a matter of how, like, yeah, it's a matter of viewing it in, like, these, like, digestible pieces versus, like, something you can build on your own to an extent, or, like...
Yeah, well, there... Okay, so, two. So, sorry.
No,
Let me rewind for okay. one second to finish that thing, because I remember what it was.
Yeah,
it was just, like, you can have a job in showbiz that just leads... That, like, you slide straight to the grave.
Yes.
You can follow a path and just die doing that thing.
Yes.
And then there is your life. And you turn it to dust, and we're done.
Yeah.
And the sun goes supernova, and everything's gone. So, yes. But to then go back to what you just said, that philosophy thing is a, I don't know, maybe people are confused. Like, there's something about philosophy that is the same thing about, like, doing comedy, where, like, the good philosophy, as in the good comedy, speaks truth to power. And that people are scared of, in a certain sense. It's a little easier to digest than comedy, maybe, because you're laughing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a Dave Chappelle or a Richard Pryor.
Right.
Is saying something that, like, is digestible because you're also laughing.
Right.
Whereas, like, Foucault saying, oh, hey, look, the way our prisons are, it goes back to these, you know, 17th century kinds of torture, and things haven't changed that much, and we've just changed, we've just kind of, like, you know, pushed it, we've absorbed it into ourselves in a certain way.
Yeah.
I realize that doesn't make a lot of sense, but...
No, I understand that. It's not mutually exclusive to be in a creative field and also, like, be kind of... following a strict path, in a sense.
You can. But I do think in a creative field, you, and I, this is to the point that you just said, there is more of a, you do have more control in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or you do have, it is less, the future is less certain.
Yeah.
And in a bad way, that causes a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
But in a good way, it's, I no longer, I mean, I fear death all the time. I was sitting with my fiance, and she was asleep in bed, and I was, like, sitting there, and our one cat was in between us, and I was petting him, and then our other cat was at my feet, and it was just this nice moment, and all I could think of was, like, oh, this is finite.
Yeah.
This is this moment's going to end. The cats are going to die.
Yeah.
And then one of us is going to die
at
some point. So it's not like suddenly, like, all my death anxiety is away, and I'm fine and yay, but it's no longer, I no longer feel, like, it's no, you know what? It no longer, to use that toboggan metaphor, it no longer feels like it's rushing past me. Like I feel the wind of the grave as it, like, rushes past me as I slide down into it.
Yeah. And how did you get it to no longer feel like that?
That, I mean, that's literally by, like, I got kicked out of grad school because I had been doing comedy mostly on the side, concentrating on that more than I was on grad school. And I hung out with my friends from grad school yesterday. I went down to Philly to hang out with them. And I was like, I asked them, I'm like, hey, I built up this narrative about how I got kicked out of grad school. Am I wrong about it? And they're like, no. So I can say this with with some authority. That I was fed up with, like, again, that analytic philosophy kind of stuff that was dominant. I was fed up with it. And I explicitly, like, right before I started my dissertation, you had to write two papers that are of publishable quality, and these are your prelims. And I wrote one that was fine because I got to write it on the question was, does art period, can it affect social change?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer was no, because I looked at, like, these guys like Bruno Latour, and Bruno Latour is this great, I don't want to say philosopher of science, but he writes science studies kind of stuff and looks at how science really works from a philosophical angle. And a lot of the times he looks at, like, how politics affects science.
Yeah.
And it's really smart and interesting. And I think the same thing works for art too.
Yeah.
And the answer is if what you're doing has some kind of ability to actually affect the levers of power, then it can actually affect change. But if that's not saying, like, so say, like, what the Yes Men do or like public demonstrations, you know, Joey Skaggs does these great art pranks. They're the stuff, but Joey Skaggs is, like, one of the people that, that affected Matt Besser, who was real, like, Matt, there's this, I remember reading an article, an interview with Matt Besser when I was in grad school, where he talked about this great book called Research. Mm-hmm. It's like a magazine journal-y kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's one issue on pranks. And there's an interview in there with Joey Skaggs. And this was someone that, like, really influenced Besser, who does these, like, big pranks in public.
Yeah.
And they're like that. They're amazing. And I think there's a use for them, but can they? I don't think they can affect change. Anyway, that was one. That was paper that passed.
Yeah.
And then this other one, which was like this, like, paper on Greek philosophy, and it had to be like, in this analytic style. Yeah. And I just rebelled and I wrote a different paper.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the comments was like, it seems like he seems competent, but he's just ignoring the rules.
Yeah. What made you want to ignore the rules? Because for me, I was a very like dedicated student, and like in the same way that like, oh, it did not occur to me that comedy was a job for a little while. It did not occur to me that I could just not write the prompt.
Like, are you from New York?
I'm from the suburbs of Philadelphia.
Right. That's right. Yeah. I remember you said that. Where?
Berwyn, near like the King of Prussia area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that off one of the trains or you have to drive
it's down? It's off the R5.
Great.
Yeah.
Paoli line?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. So like what made you, you know, you're in grad school, you're essentially almost done, right? It's your dissertation?
I'll give you the answer because fuck them.
Yeah.
A, it's partly like youthful rebelliousness, mm-hmm. like this kind of arrogant, like in retrospect, very arrogant, like, I know what's going on.
Sure.
Excuse me, professor. Yeah. I think I've got the answers. Like, I'm wearing, like, a leather jacket. I'm kicking in the door.
Yeah.
Pounding the jukebox. I don't know if we're going to go with the Fonz
metaphor. We're going with the Fonz metaphor. Yeah.
I deserve an A. I tried. Hey, as I'm saying it, I'm shaking my head. That
I'm a punter. I liked it.
All right. So part of it's like... And part of it is, like, genuinely a critique of what they were doing and saying, hey, this really isn't the right... This is not doing anything to advance our understanding of what it means to be human.
Yeah.
Like, at its core, the best part of philosophy is that it explains what it means to be human and, like, how we should live our lives in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important still.
Yeah.
But I think... 90 to 95% of the discipline, at least here in America, is not aimed towards that.
Mm.
So it's partly like youthful, like, fuck you, pal.
Yeah.
I know what's best. And partly like, oh, for real, you are shitty. The thing you're doing is shitty.
So it seems like you had like conviction from a somewhat young age of just like what works for you. Is that an accurate statement, do you think?
Yeah, arrogance. Like,
yeah, okay, arrogance.
Like arrogance and narcissism that I know is right, which you have to have in some way to write or perform professionally,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
In some, like, you don't want it to... There are some people I met in L.A. where I feel like their narrative overtook them.
Mm.
Like, their story about themselves, their narcissism... replaced, and there's people here in New York that are like that, so I'm not just saying it's LA, but there's some people who that stuff replaced, like, overwrote the code of their personality, of their humanity, and their empathy.
Yeah.
So you can go too far with it, but you need some amount in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my parents, I remember... My dad saying to me when I was younger, like sarcastically, oh, your parents are so stupid. Someday, like, because I would, like, be arrogant and be like, I know what's best for whatever. Like, you don't tell me what to do. I mean, part of it's also just like this, like, knee-jerk anti-authority. I was going to say anti-authoritarianism, which is true, but also just anti-authority.
Yeah.
My mom's an English teacher. Yeah. I would ask her for help.
Yeah.
With papers when I was younger.
Yeah.
And argue with her then. Like, she's a fucking English teacher with a master's.
Yeah. And you went to her for help.
And I went to her for help, and she would, like, give me, like, legitimate help, and I would argue with her. I mean, it's knee-jerk in such a bad way. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm in therapy.
Yeah.
And so I'm obviously, like, working on this stuff. But, like, Naomi and I are... My fiancé, Naomi, she's a stand-up.
Yeah.
Incredible stand-up. And we're doing this bit together... where she tells her jokes about me, and then I give my side of the story.
Oh,
because I've watched her do jokes about me.
Have also watched her do jokes about you.
So we've been doing this bit together, and we were doing this. We were going over it, like, we're listening to a recording of it, and like trying to like sharpen up some of the, because her jokes are done. Like, she's done these jokes; they're solid, they work.
Yeah,
and my half of it. We were building up from the ground up.
Yeah.
And we're doing something, and she's like, oh, I think you should get to the punchline faster. Mm-hmm. She completely right, by the way, 100% right. And my need, like, anger immediately rose mm-hmm. in my chest, mm-hmm. and I had to, like, check myself, be mm-hmm. like, oh, she's right. Like, she is totally correct about this, so swallow your anger, because this is a knee-jerk response. Yeah. So, yes, the answer to this is yes. Mostly in a negative way. Like, that conviction is mostly negative, but also, like, the thing that, like, got me to this spot, where, this hazy half area where I am now.
So it's interesting. Do you find that, like, do you find it has been an obstacle? Because it sounds like it's helped you in a lot of ways, because you seem like you've been able to sort of be aware of it, mm-hmm. so that it hasn't been, like, an obstacle to some things that you want, but more so illuminates things you do want, rather than, like with the philosophy thing, it, like, illuminated the idea that you did not want to follow this analytic philosophy thing.
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to be doing comedy. I remember, like, when I found out that I got kicked out, literally, I felt sad for, like, I mean, I felt sad as I was saying this thing, but, like, 5 seconds later, I found out, I was sitting with some friends, I'm like, well, guess I'm moving to New York to do comedy. Mm. Like, it's like, oh, well, this didn't work out. I guess I have to go do the thing I really wanted to do.
Right.
That I was too scared to just... Because, look, I was getting a sweet stipend. $14,000 a year? Oh, man, that sweet cash.
That nice Pittsburgh money or Philadelphia money.
Oh, man, living in South Philly in a one-bedroom for $500 a month? Yeah. Oh, man, that lifestyle.
Yeah.
So... obstacle. It's a contradiction.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Cause, like, yes, it is an obstacle, but it's also good at the same time.
Right.
So I think it's definitely a contradiction to possibly be worked out.
Yeah.
Because you want to keep the good part of it, but you want to lessen the bad part of it, but that's tough.
Yeah.
It's like empathy is also a contradiction. Because you need empathy. You desperately need empathy. Like, everyone, look, I mean, we live in a shitty world where not enough people have empathy.
Right.
Or people are so blinded by their own lives that that their empathy is kind of just clouded over. So, professionally, you need empathy to be a full human and not a Seinfeldian shell. I don't know him as a person. He might his private life, he could be... perfectly
a big,
empathetic.
Warm, open book.
We don't know. but you don't, like, so as a human, you want it. Professionally, it's, like, desperately you need it.
Yeah.
If you're a writer, you need to be able to put yourself in other people's shoes.
Yeah.
Like, both your characters and your audience. As a performer, you have to definitely, if you can't read your audience, you're dead.
Yeah.
As an improviser or as a stand-up or as a sketch writer, like, any of that stuff, sketch performer. But also, like, at a certain point, if you, you need a point of view, like, mm-hmm. you need to be able to, and this is what's really difficult, is that if you have empathy, you can see everyone's point of view.
Sure.
So it's tough to, like, hold on to one, because you're like, well, I guess I see everyone else's side of the story, too.
Yes.
It's the problem with liberal politics in the United States a little bit, because partly it's like, oh, I don't like real conservatives. I don't have a problem with. I guess I have a problem with, like, Tea Party conservatives or racist, homophobic conservatives mm-hmm. or, like, people who are, like, fiscally conservative or, like, oh no, there's something important about, like, watching how much money it's like that the country spends or, like, where rights are reserved. Are they, like, states' rights or federal?
Mm-hmm.
Like, can the federal government intervene? Like, yeah, I guess those are important questions.
Yeah.
But, totally lost. Oh, but when you can start seeing, when you start seeing their point of view, you, like, lose yourself and you become this kind of diffuse.
Mm-hmm.
Ever play Metroid Corruption, which I've been playing lately?
No, I haven't.
These little phazon objects, these little, like, balls of the, energy.
Yeah.
You become a diffuse ball of energy.
Well, then how do you ground yourself in those moments, do you think? Or, like, maintain your personality and point of view throughout the midst? Because for me, like, I find I have to force myself to have tunnel vision sometimes, whether it means just, like, don't go on Facebook, Just like simple as that. Don't go on and see what all the great things all your friends are doing all the time. Ugh. And see like what you want to do for that
compare
day.
Compare and despair is the worst.
Yeah.
A friend, I'll answer that question. A friend of mine, like friend from grad school I was talking to yesterday, I was saying like, it's tough because you see so many of your friends. What's actually tough is like you see them get things, but that you would never had a chance, like you weren't up for.
Right.
Naomi wrote on Broad City.
Yeah.
This second season, this last summer, which is amazing. Like I was pure, like here's the thing. I was, when it first started, I was just purely happy for her.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
No worries. No worries.
I was purely happy. Like, and that I can say genuinely. And then as the summer wore on, I had like a couple writing jobs here and there, but things are like only like a week here and there.
Yeah.
And I just remember one morning she went to work and I'm sweeping up cat hair.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, actually, you know what? It may have been worse when I was doing a writing job because I was writing on, and it was really fun and amazing, by the way. So I'm not decrying it, but I was writing on like a reality show on the CW. I was writing jokes for one of the hosts. And I was like, oh, Naomi's writing on a hit show, mm-hmm. and I'm sweeping up cat hair, or I'm, you know, churning out, you know, a page of jokes about Texas or something like that. So, but I was never up for a writing job in Broad City.
Right.
I was never, I'm friends with Alana and Abby, sure, but like, Naomi was the writer's assistant last year. I'm not someone who has experiences that are experiences that Alana and Abby could turn into episodes. I can imagine experiences. I can make up things.
Yeah.
But like, that's not a job I was up for.
Yeah.
So if, am I really, can I ever like sit there and be like jealous of Naomi? Mm-hmm. I think no.
Yeah.
I think I can be like a little depressed that I'm sweeping up cat hair.
Of course.
Or she's getting, you know, has a paid writing job. But compare and despair. Like, any time you do that, the only time you should feel bad is if you were up for something and didn't get it. Otherwise, you're just living in this kind of petty, jealous fantasy land. And that's only going to kind of, like, knot itself into cancer. Like, a mental cancer. And, you know, I don't know how many connections there are between mind and body. The more I perform, the more I feel like it's not a dichotomy, that it's one complex thing that really interacts on a very deep level.
Yeah.
So maybe that turns into real cancer. I'm not going to say. But I'm just like feel bad if you were up for something. But if you're like, if go on Facebook and someone gets something, or someone like makes a video for whatever place that you want to make a video for, like, it's not. Even if I pitched, my friend Rich and I pitched some cartoons to Above Average.
Yeah.
And they, we got to the second stage. So the first stage is you pitch. The second stage is if they like your pitch, they'll ask you to write a sample script.
Mm-hmm.
And so they liked it. We wrote a sample script. They liked that, but they're like, oh, it's kind of Adult Swimmy. Mm. It's not really for us. We really love it though. And we hope you make it. Which is really nice of them. Like they didn't have to say any of that.
Mm-hmm.
They could have said, oh, they could have just passed on it. So even, okay, so someone, so like, I don't know, Amos and Mike, friends of mine were in Boat. They just did a web series. Am I going to be jealous of them because their web series got picked up and mine didn't?
Yeah.
No, like it's not, like even if you're up for something, some like similar-ish thing from the same company, I feel like the only time you like have you have ownership of like feeling bad for something is if literally you were up for the same job and someone else got it. And then even then I feel like go ahead, feel depression. But if you feel like feel jealousy too, like that, like feel okay with it. But if you let it like, if you let it metastasize, then that's on you.
I think the thing that prevents that metastasizing is like this idea that's sort of the flip side of the same coin that you're saying of like, just because that person got this above average web series or whatever actually doesn't mean anything about you. Like, it means something about them. It means they got an above average series. It doesn't mean that you couldn't in the future, like specifically with you, that they didn't like yours. They did. Like, it literally actually means nothing about you. But I think it's so easy to make it seem like, oh man, thank God this about, like, that means I suck. It's like, actually, they're unrelated.
That's
like,
a beautiful point. That you're, that somehow in your mind, you start connecting things.
Yeah.
That don't have connect. You know what? It's almost like if you let yourself go and you don't check yourself, you turn into a conspiracy theorist when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah.
Because what a conspiracy theorist does is they connect unrelated things.
Yeah.
And give it meaning and import.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is connecting unrelated things.
Yes.
If Amos and Mike and Nunzio.
Yeah.
I like Nunzio. We're just, by the way, I didn't mention him. I like him. I just, I don't know him as well as Mike and Amos.
Yeah, yeah.
If they get something that's unrelated to you getting it. That's not a zero-sum game. Obviously, there's some kind of zero-sum game-ish thing going on where above average only has a certain amount of money.
Sure.
And so they can only fund a certain amount of things.
Sure.
And they also have a brand. I hate using that phrase.
But they do. They do.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
And so, like, within that rubric of, like, what do they produce and how much money do they have, they can give it to a certain... So there's a zero-sum game-ish thing, but... Someone getting something like that that you don't get is very unrelated. It's related, it's tenuous at best.
Yeah.
So you turn yourself into like a 9/11 conspiracy theorist when you start letting yourself indulge in these fantasies. And it is an indulgence, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And it's like, it's not that you can help it sometimes, but just like knowing that reality check, I don't think some people have that in place of like, oh, wait, this actually doesn't mean anything about me. Even the flip side of that, of like a lot of good things happening maybe at once, and you're like, the stars are aligning, everything. It's like, actually, those are potentially depending on what they are, unrelated too.
Yep.
So if it doesn't work out, it doesn't mean this big like rug has been swept from underneath you and that was your only chance because the stars were in perfect alignment. It's like, no, actually, your brain connected things and made it seem like that was the precious one thing, and it's not.
Yep, that's a beautiful point. It is, when I taught philosophy, because I was also teaching when I was in grad school.
Yeah.
And I taught a critical reasoning course at the small college called Cabrini. It was a fun course. And one of the things that you, when you're teaching critical reasoning or logic or something like that, is that...
No worries.
Is that, so say, like, people will think, so say George calls you, and you're like, George, I was just thinking about you. Yes. We have a psychic connection.
Of course, yes.
They are ignoring all of the times that George called and they weren't thinking of George, or all the times that they were thinking of George and George didn't call.
Yes.
Right? So you self-select these kind of, I forget what it's called now. I think it's like a positive bias or something. There's some phrase for it, do you know?
I took psych and knew at one point and do not know anymore.
There's some, so yeah, but you know about it. So there's something, so like you will self-select all these like positive things, or it depends on like your personality too. Like this is why I think there's like so much complexity when you move. Like if you're working an office job, yeah, there is complexity. I'm not denying that.
Yeah.
Because your personality and the personalities of the people, like the last job I worked at NYU, there were some like great people there, but there were some like terrible people there that like there was stuff going on behind the scenes where they would like make up things to get other people in trouble and things like that. So yeah, so it's not like an office job is free of drama.
Yes.
In fact, there might be more drama there because people are bored and need to create some kind of excitement in their lives. That's speculation.
Yes.
Point being, but because of the hierarchy that I think constrains it, that your personalities don't factor in as much as say in a creative career.
For sure.
Where I think, so like on the level of personality, there's all that complex stuff where like, how do you react to the stuff? How do you fit in? I forget what I was saying.
You were talking about, you taught philosophy and the idea of false connections between positive or negative events. Like the idea, oh, George called me.
How are you going to react to stuff? Like how you react to stuff and how your personality, that's like this basic level of like a show busy kind of career. And you know, because like some people, this is what I was going to say. Some people have depression, or some people are like naturally will pessimist or something like that. So we'll self-select in the negative. Oh, this shows that I'm terrible, or this shows that I'm bad. Even if it's like generally like maybe neutral or even positive. It could be positive.
Yeah.
Or people, you know, have unnatural hope and positivity, and so they'll self-select the other way.
Right.
And it's tough to have an objective. I mean, look, let's get Nietzschean, right?
Yeah.
No one can have an objective.
You can't.
No one can see something from a God's eye view.
Yeah.
But for real, it's tough to have an objective view. But you can try. You should strive. Striving, streben, the German.
And the idea, too, even if you are striving for an objective point of view, because I find that my brain always thinks, I'm like, you're being objective right now because you're being realistic, like, or whatever. You're reminding yourself that this cool thing you got doesn't actually mean this, like, greater big thing or things like that. But then there's also this matter of, like, well, is that helpful to think like that? Is it, like, what will help me continue to do more cool things? To think, give yourself a reality check?
Mm-hmm.
Or to think, like, more cool things will come, surely. Like, I think that's also personality dependent. Unlike if you really, really work off of kind of just being like, that's not enough, more. Or like being like, I did a good thing. This might mean I can do another good thing. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's just food for thought.
I can think of, what's that song that's more, more, more?
Oh. More. There you go. That's the anthem. When you were at NYU, was that full time?
Yeah. Full time day job.
Okay. So I'm going to get, if you had to like break down like your Wikipedia bullet points of like when you left grad school and moved to New York to become a comedian, what were like your like, yeah, like in that like career bullet point list?
Oh,
what
God.
What would it be?
Oh, I mean like day jobs?
Yeah, day jobs.
Jeez. Oh, they were terrible. Like I moved here because I thought I could get a day job. See, even the beginning, I was like, I was playing it safe.
Mm.
And a friend of mine worked at a company that did due diligence on hedge fund managers.
Yeah.
This is right before the crash.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh, I can, you just write reports on these people.
Yeah.
You do like some investigation online and you write reports on them. And I can probably get you a job here. So I came to New York with it, you know, with that in my back pocket.
Yeah.
Then the all that chicanery around the around Wall Street happened, and everything crashed. And this was June of 2008.
Yeah.
And then September, it all fell apart for real. And so that was gone. And so I just started getting temp jobs. I sold my guitar in August of that year to pay for rent.
Wow.
And it was like a lot of like selling things to pay for rent.
Yeah.
And so temp jobs, I did like just little temp jobs for this agency. I don't even want to say their name.
Yeah.
And then they got me a job at this big law firm. I got fired from that. I can go into the story if you want, but you just said bullet points. So fired from that. Then I got another job. I'd never been fired for a job, by the way.
Yeah.
Ever before moving to New York. Never. Not once. So in quick succession, by the way, kicked out of grad school.
Wow.
I taught for a year in Philly just to save some money. So got kicked out in 2007, moved here in 2008.
Yeah.
So get fired from that job. I got another job at this terrible insurance agency on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Who, by the skin of their teeth, had not gotten into the subprime mortgage game, but still were pretty shady.
Yeah.
And eventually I got carpal tunnel syndrome because work was so intense and so awful and boring. And they fired me because I had carpal, because I couldn't do the work fast. The woman brings me into her office and she goes, so you know, because you work through a temp agency that you have no claim on, like, we don't have to pay any medical stuff.
Oh,
and I'm like,
God.
Oh, yeah, sure, I know that. She's like, okay, because we have to let you go. I'm like, it may not have been as nice as that. But so get fired from that. Then I go, I was really happy because I went on unemployment.
Yeah.
So I'm on unemployment for a while. I got a job for a couple months the next summer. So I'm on unemployment for a long time looking for work.
Yeah.
I get a job the next summer as a assistant to a Broadway producer for a couple months, which was awful. Just because he was so wealthy, he lived in this like penthouse on the like 60s, like off the one, like that area, like very nice. Like you could see his apartment. I saw his finances once cost $12,000 a month to live in that apartment. It's like well-appointed, beautiful apartment with this gorgeous, giant picture windows and gorgeous view of the park. And just like, oh, I'm so far away from, not that I'm seeking wealth, but stability would be nice at some point.
Yeah.
But like to be thrust into that was like, oh God. And then, I can't remember. It's little jobs. It's just like little temp jobs here and there. Oh, I totally skipped my year at the College Board.
Oh.
The guys who do the SATs.
Yeah, I know them.
Got fired from that for no reason. I was the assistant to some director there.
Yeah.
And I had access to her email because I had to send stuff out as her.
Yeah.
And so I don't know why but I saw an email that was about firing me like 2 weeks before it actually happened. So I got at least a 2 week head start. But again, it was like literally for no reason. I think she didn't like me.
Wow.
I think that's. And I don't mean, like, look, I feel like I've been pretty honest. So, like, when I say for no reason, I mean that I've been doing the job fine. I think she was not, she just didn't like my personality. Wow. So, then the summer after that, so this is 2010, was that. And then, for 4 months of job temping at Columbia as an admin assistant.
Yeah.
And then, when that ended, the worst job of my life, which was at as a admin assistant at this executive search firm. I won't go all into it. If you want to look up on Twitter, hashtag shitty temp job.
Oh my God.
I tweeted about it. And it's funny. I also collected it as like a Tumblr post.
Yeah.
If you like looking that up, I'm sure if you looked up shitty temp job in hashtag shitty temp job in Google, you could find out that whole thing.
Yeah.
And then what saved me was the NYU job.
Wow.
Which I was at for almost 2 years until I got the Pete Holmes job.
Wow. So, okay. So, many questions. So what do you, how did you not feel discouraged from like having all these jobs that like.
I did.
Well, then, then the second question, like, how did you overcome that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm naturally, I mean, part of it's just my personality, my biology, just like, you know, my background. I was always like a great student. Again, I don't mean that like in a braggy kind of way, but I was like top of my class, got scholarships to, undergrad and grad school, you know, always get, so I was always praised, won my ninth grade science fair.
Oh, wait, did you hear that around?
So I was always praised for that, and not unduly. Like, my parents would definitely admonish me if I did something wrong. Like, you know, it's not like I grew up with constant praise. Like, I believe you millennials might be where, like, you can do nothing wrong.
Yeah, not me, but yeah. Definitely did not get that.
Yes, so I think that's definitely, like, buoyed me.
Yeah.
Buoyed? Buoy?
Buoy sounds buoy. Right.
I think that's how you say the thing that floats is a buoy.
Yeah.
So
I would say buoyed.
So yeah. So that definitely has buoyed me.
Yeah.
Booer and and I think also like being able to do honestly like just being like there's also an enthusiasm when you start off.
Yeah.
That it's the same like when you start doing comedy and you have a natural aptitude for it. Because it's, I remember my first improv class at UCB. I was like, "Oh, this is just what my friends and I do."
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I talked to Ian Roberts on Beginnings, that he had said, "Like, yeah, I think if you've been goofing off with your friends since I think it's tough if you haven't been goofing off with your friends since a young age to start doing comedy later in life. But if you have been doing that and you kind of like heightening like." It's just what you do with your friends. You make a joke, and then everyone heightens until it gets to absurdity.
Yeah.
And, that's exactly what you do. Like, it's a little different in improv because you have to learn how to act that out instead of, like, just
talking
saying the
it.
Next parts. But, like, if you feel, like, you kind of feel it in your bone. Like, it's a bodily thing. That's the other thing that, I don't know why I decided to just go off this tangent. But, coming from, like, a really intellectual background, or coming from philosophy and all the stuff that's, like, very cerebral, learning that your body tells you so much stuff, and that if you learn to trust... So, like, that idea, what I said before, like, transforming yourself into this creature, also transforming yourself into a creature that follows their gut.
Yeah.
More than their brain. Like, the often the brain, like, that stuff, like, you're like, how do you, like, how did you just put it?
Which question?
How do you stop from feeling discouraged?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, how did you keep
going?
Part of
that is that transforming. So stop listening to your brain. I guess, you know, like, I love UCB. I'm not stumping for them. Yeah. But, like, don't think is a really smart...
Yeah.
Smart catchphrase in the sense that, yeah, you want... Like, look, when you're on the back line and you are trying... You need to come up with something. Yeah, like, throw out your first idea or two if it's shitty and go with, you know... Whatever. I mean, I don't think third thought always works. But like, yeah, think, like, you're not turning yourself off, but, like, follow, like, when your gut, when you think of an idea and your gut says, oh, yeah, that's the one.
Well, it's like this, the idea you brought up in the beginning of, like, this idea of thriving on at least a little bit of chaos, of, like, being able to step before you necessarily know where you're stepping.
Yep.
In a sense. And, like, that's a big thing. You know, in terms of, you just moved to New York after grad school. That's, like, a huge step before you know where you're stepping, because, like, New York is one of the major cities to be in if you want to do comedy. So, and it's, like, not like you moved with a job in mind. So that's really interesting.
Ish.
That, like, yeah?
Ish. It all fell out within 2 weeks. It all fell out from underneath me, but yeah.
Wow. See, that's, yeah, that's really interesting. And, like, okay, so we have your bullet points. So you worked at NYU. And then how did you start writing for the Pete Holmes Show?
Yeah, this is convoluted, but you want to hear the little steps.
Yeah, I do.
So Naomi was the writer's assistant on Broad City for the first season.
Yes.
And she's an amazing stand-up. So they did Abby and Alana, they have a monthly show at UCB. And while they were writing, they did one that was just the writers.
I went to that one.
So you saw her kill.
Yes.
This is not, like... I love Paul and Lucia and Chris Kelly and everyone else that was on the show. Naomi, objectively, was the best there. She killed.
She killed Leibowitz.
And she, when they did it again this year, when they, she was on this year, she killed again.
Yes.
So their manager was, like, courting her.
Fuck yeah.
Okay, so she, Sam Safer, sends Naomi a bunch of packets to write.
Yeah.
Like, at midnight and Pete Holmes showing the stuff. And Seth Meyers. And Naomi didn't... She knew that I was a big fan of Pete's and that I listened to You Made It Weird.
Always.
And so she's like, do you want to... Here, do you want Pete's... Like, I don't want to write this. I don't know Pete's voice very well.
Yeah.
Do you want this? And I'm like, sure. But we have to find out, like, I can write it. Like, now that I have this packet through this, like, kind of surreptitious means...
Mm-hmm.
We still have to get into someone's hands. Like, she can't be like to Sam Safer,
I didn't write this,
but my fiance did. So can you hand this in for like, that's not how that works. I mean, we could have just asked, but she might've said like, I don't feel comfortable or I don't want to, or I don't know who Andy is.
Yeah.
But we're friends with Jamie Lee. Jamie Lee is Pete's ex-girlfriend and she wrote on the pilot for the show.
Yes.
And Naomi wrote her and said, hey, if Andy writes this, would you mind giving it to Pete?
Nice.
And Jamie, who is like one of the sweetest, nicest people, said, sure, why not?
Awesome.
I wrote it. I had 3 days. So it was due Friday. Okay. I got it on Tuesday. So I wrote and rewrote. I sent it to my friend Joe, who was awesome and gave me notes and rewrote it and then gave it to Jamie. And I sent with a note that said, hey, if you don't think this is up to snuff or you don't think it's funny, I'm not offended if you don't send it to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's, you're doing me a favor. It's really nice of you. So thank you.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
But she liked it. So she sent it to Pete. And then Naomi and I was doing a live beginnings at the Out of Bounds Festival in Austin.
Yeah.
So we go down that weekend to Austin, and on we get back Monday, and we're just, like, relaxing. We're chilling on the couch. And I get an IM from... Here's the other piece. I get an IM from the executive producer, Nick Bernstein.
Yeah.
Nick is... because of, see, here's where like all these pieces come together where you don't know, like, why I'm saying like there's all this complexity in showbiz. A year earlier, Pete had been on Beginnings, like very early on, like mm-hmm. episode 18. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an idea, it comes out weekly. We're on episode, as of taping this, episode 173.
Wow.
Just aired.
Yeah.
So early on in the show, before Pete was like Pete, I just, yeah. I loved his stand up.
Yeah.
And
so you knew him from the
stand-up
scene.
This is before his podcast. This is mm-hmm. before his podcast. And he had moved to LA. I think he was writing on Outsourced or something. Yeah. He was back at Big Terrific. So we talked to him after Big Terrific. And Nick was a fan of Pete's, and they were working together on something, I guess what eventually became the Pete Holmes Show.
Yeah.
And they, Nick was a former NBC late night executive.
Okay.
And he left at some point. I think, you know, there was like a big shift at some point in the, like 2011 or 2012. Yeah. I forget. I don't pay that much attention to it. But, and he was doing some other stuff. This is before the Pete Holmes Show. And he asked Mark and I to pitch him some ideas for some project he was doing.
Yeah.
So we did. We pitched him. So he knew who I was from that.
Yeah.
So he IMs me, he G-chats me, I guess, and says, hey, are you still in New York? Because there's this thing, I talked to Anthony King,
yeah.
who was a writer on Broad City this year at some party, and he's like, there's this thing in L.A. where they can't believe that anyone from New York would ever jump on a plane and come out for something.
That's crazy.
It's... What for whatever reason.
That's
so there's
funny.
That
wow.
Which is why there's like such a big exodus of people from New York to LA
yeah.
in the past like 3 or 4 years. So I realize this is convoluted.
No,
this
no,
is
no.
a long
this
story, but I'm trying to pull out the pieces
yes.
so that it's not so that you see how it all falls into place.
Yes.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm in New York. And then I quickly added, and I like showed Naomi this, and she's like, what? And I'm like, what? I'm like, I would move out though, right, Naomi? Like, we would, something, she's like, we'd figure it out.
Yeah.
And so I quick wrote, yeah, but I, if there's something going on, I would come out to LA in a second.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh, okay, great. And we talked a little bit more. And then I think the next day he said, hey, can we interview you on Skype on Wednesday? So I came to work with my computer. I reserved a boardroom
at NYU
secretly.
Yes.
And on my lunch hour, I interviewed with Pete and Nick and
yeah.
Oren Brimmer,
yeah,
who was the co-executive producer. And it was great up until, you know, I had ideas for things, like I had ideas that weren't in the packet that
yeah.
they liked and some other stuff. And up until they're like, so what have your other TV jobs been? I'm like, oh, I haven't written on a TV show before. And they were like, oh.
Wow.
Because my packet had been so dynamite.
Hell yeah.
Because I was a fan. Look,
here's
the thing. I had been writing comedy. Like, the first years of my sketch group wrestling team mm-hmm. are, like, insane and nonsensical.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I would have anyone watch that stuff now. But I have been writing stuff since 2003.
You did like an 80-minute show, you
yes.
said.
Yes, and I think some of it still is very good.
Yeah.
I would use some of that stuff. If I was really desperate, if I was like Woody Allen in his 70s,
yeah,
and I'm looking for old scripts, I might take some of that stuff and rewrite it. It still
yeah.
makes me laugh, and I think there's still some, the games of those sketches are still funny.
Yeah.
But, and I had been, like, really putting my nose to the grindstone since 2009.
Yeah.
I took my first UCB class in May of 2009.
Yeah.
And since, you know, since then to up to this was, like, what, 2013, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had just been, like, writing, performing,
yeah.
performing. So it's not like this was just, like, I was just some bumpkin.
Oh,
who,
of course.
Like, sent in a packet and was like, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, of course.
So that was a little disappointing because I saw like the obvious, I saw them obviously kind of like, oh, we can't, this is a new show. We can't risk anything on this
right.
guy. What eventually happened was this weird kind of convoluted thing. They hired me and do you know Chris Thayer?
Who's a stand-up? I know who I've heard of him. Yeah.
They hired us as digital writers.
Oh.
What that meant was almost nothing because we wrote and pitched on the show.
Interesting. So it's just like a superficial title?
Yes. So I feel like I'm like, the show's over. I never wanted to say any of the stuff while the show was still going on because they could get in trouble with the WGA.
Yeah.
But I feel a little okay saying it now. I don't think anything can happen.
Yeah, only like 6 people listen to this also.
Well, this is for your...
Yes.
Still.
Yeah.
Which is that they hired us as digital writers, but then we wrote on the show, pitched, in the room every... Like, there was... The functional difference between us and the other writers was that we got paid 1/4 of what they got paid.
That's it. It's funny because I looked something up about you on the Pete Holmes show, and it said it listed you as it listed you as part of the staff. I was going to say staff writer. Mm-hmm. So is that part of that distinction? Is just saying things like that?
Well, it's partly because like they hired this great guy Adam Stein who wrote some of the funniest stuff on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was between me and him. He had written for. He had written a pilot with the Always Sunny guys. He had written on Ugly Americans, which is an amazing show. Very funny dude, but had TV experience. So I think that's what it came down to. I think that's what it came down to.
Yeah.
But they liked my... Can I say that they loved my packet? Can I be a little proud of it?
You can be...
Out of two... That was the second packet I ever wrote. That's the only second packet I've ever... That's the only other packet. I wrote one for Colbert.
Yeah.
I actually think it was really good, too. But,
yeah.
So, that was the only... I mean, if existentially, like, there was a more anxiety from my point of view.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, I'm not... I'm doing everything the other writers are doing, but I don't have the title, technically... But, like, Chris Thayer wrote one of the funniest jokes on the show.
Yeah.
Like, a joke that just killed. So, it's not, like, I can point out jokes of mine or, like, things that I contributed. So, it really isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Sorry, am I being boring?
No. You're not being boring. I have too many questions about this. Because I was going to actually ask, so backtrack a little bit, the process of your writing your packet, since you said... You had done Colbert's packet before that?
Around the same time.
How did you... What is your process like when writing in general and when writing these packets?
Packets are a little more... Because they're deadline intensive.
Yes. And they're really... They want specific types of things, like a character sketch or like whatever they might be asking for.
It's different. Like Colbert, because you have to write... I mean, I don't know what it is now, but last year you had to write a word.
Yeah.
And you had to write... I mean, I don't even know if they're bothering to get any more people because they're ending. So I don't know how much of this is worthwhile to anyone, but you had to write a wag and a fingertip of the hat. You had to write two of those and I think the word. So that was more about, like, finding the perfect... Like, for the word... You have to actually have a real argument about something.
Yeah.
And so you write the argument first and then you write jokes afterwards.
Yes.
Because you have to make a real point. You can't just... And you have to make a point in the Colbert character. You can't just, you can't just write something funny. So I had to find an issue. I had to, I mean, I already read, a ton of, lefty news sites anyway. Yeah. So it was just about finding the right thing. I think it was about... At that time, it was crazy to me... This was before, I mean, this year it's gotten even worse, but the lethal injections.
Oh.
Now a bunch of states are just using chemicals and they're not telling anyone where they come from. And, prisoners are dying in agony and they're taking, hours to die.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't think it's right in the first place.
Right.
But if we're going to do it. So anyway, but at that time, this was the beginning of it, where Texas had run out of lethal injection chemicals. And instead of, maybe saying, well, we'll delay executions, they were trying to find, chemicals, anywhere they could.
Yes.
And so, that was crazy to me. So I think that was what the word was about.
Yeah.
And then it was about, I feel good about this. It the argument then, extrapolated into the, what else they could do if they don't have lethal injection drugs.
Yeah.
The Onion did a video like that where they had, this disgusting, mashing machine, like one of the videos. Oh, yeah, ew. That it was real. It was like amazing. It was such a good video.
Yeah.
So the process for that is like finding the right thing. And same thing with Pete. With Pete, because there was no show yet, so it was like you had to write a lot of stuff. Him and Oren and Matt McCarthy were part of whatever their production company is, I forget now what it's called, but they had been making videos for years.
Yeah.
So you had to write, like, there's a doctor video. And it was on the show, too, I think.
Yeah.
Where Pete's a bad doctor. Like, a lot of the sketches were Pete's a bad lawyer, Pete's a bad bartender. And so you had to write those.
Yeah.
So the three of those, and I forget what else you had to write for. Oh, you had to write a pop sketch. You had to write a pop culture sketch. Just outline it, like say what the. Okay. I mean, they didn't speak in UCB terms, but essentially they wanted you to say what the game was and what the beats might be.
Yeah.
And I remember they were impressed with mine because I wrote a Breaking Bad sketch, but the game I wrote the outline for it, but the game of it was just that. It's him and Skyler talking at a table, mm-hmm. and Skyler is enumerating all the horrible things mm-hmm. that Walter White's done. And in the show, his whole thing was that he would give excuses.
Yes.
No, what I'm doing is really good, and here's why. Yes. And so she enumerated, and as she enumerated worse and worse things that go into absurdity, his explanations become more and more, no, this is a good thing. Yes. This is a good thing. And they were like, yeah, we got a ton of, like, pun breaking, but like breaking bread. And I was like, I was incredulous, because I was just like, really?
Yeah.
Because, like, why would you write a sketch that's, like, basically a Mad Magazine parody?
Yeah.
So, it was, like, finding the right stuff and finding the... Again, those sketches, the doctor sketches, finding a fun game that was worth writing. I mean, I still like those, the ones I wrote for that. And you had to write a monologue that was in the spirit of, like, the kind of monologues that were done on the show.
Yeah.
That were flowing. And so I wrote one of those, and they liked the jokes in that, so...
Nice.
So they were in Pete's voice, because I knew Pete's voice. Again, I knew Colbert's voice.
Yeah.
And Pete's voice. They're both similar in a certain way to my voice.
Yeah.
So it's not I tried writing a packet for Seth Meyers, because Naomi also got the packet for that. And she's like, you want to try this? I was like, sure. And Seth Meyers' voice isn't close to mine.
Yeah.
So I had a real tough time writing. I wrote a couple jokes, monologue jokes, and then I stopped.
Yeah.
By the way, it's not an insult or anything.
No, it's just a different voice.
But it's just like, it's not my it's not my voice, so I don't have a trouble.
Yeah. And can I ask, how did the Colbert packet come about?
We are friends with one of the producers.
Nice.
And he opened up. He was like, hey, we're trying to, in this round, we're trying to like just find a lot of different people for this. So if you, he said, if you and Andy want to submit.
Yeah.
That's it. It's really like... It's not, again, it sounds all the stuff sounds nepotism-y, but I think all of it really is nepotism-y.
I also think it is, but there's ways where it's like gross, like fake friendship type of like only schmoozing with like people because they're important. And then there's like legitimate, like, oh, my buddy just happens to work for this.
I call that career face, because when you're, I want to have a better name for it.
Yeah.
But it's like when you're at a party and someone... I see it as, like, they're, like, seeing the world like Terminator.
Yeah.
Like, the Terminator. And it's all, like, they're breaking down, like, what you can do for them for their career. I prefer a term I call non-cynical networking.
Yeah.
Where you actually, like, you're actually friends with people.
Yeah.
And, like, you have a meaningful friendship. And you are good at what you do so that they don't mind helping you.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing. Like, people, as long as you are... As long as you're good and a hard worker and driven, then people don't mind helping you.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're not like a dick. Because, I mean, I went to film school, so ran into a problem of just like, I didn't like a lot of people. And actually, it's strange. It's actually kind of the opposite of what I just said of like, sometimes people would just like flock to them because they're like talented, even though they're bad people.
Yeah, those people are terrible. I don't want to be near them.
Yeah, that's my whole thing now. Like, I don't care. I don't want to work with people I don't like because it's uncomfortable and it makes me worse. It makes me not say what my idea is because I'm like, oh, this person's better than me. That's why I like, ask them to help. They're like, you know, they've had these credits behind them or whatever. It's like, fuck that. I'll ask my roommate to do it. Like, kind of thing. Cool. So then, oh man, so many questions. So as a writer, or so after the Pete Holmes show, it was two seasons, right?
Well, they ended in, the first season ended and it was not joyous because the ratings had started off okay.
Yeah.
And then this is the first time I ever had to follow the ratings for something.
Yeah.
So I was looking at them on this website online.
Yeah.
And at some point, the ratings were so low that they stopped reporting.
Wow.
Here's the thing. Yeah. Here's what I say about the show. It's not a bad show at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wrong, Midnight After Conan is the wrong space for it.
Mm-hmm.
Pete's energy, it's just like what does well at Midnight? At Midnight, yeah. But I mean, what really does well is Adult Swim.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are looking for like weird, yes, stonery kind of stuff at that point.
Yeah.
At Midnight, and like Pete's stuff was like meaningful. Like the mm-hmm. stuff he did with Rob Bell mm-hmm. was like, oh, that there's some like something real about that.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, so it ends. Everyone's not that hopeful because we didn't get a pickup at that moment. Mm-hmm. And I come back here to New York because Naomi's still living here.
Yeah,
and you know we've been having a long distance relationship for 3 months.
Yeah,
and it was like awful. I missed my cats. I missed Naomi. And
yeah.
And then, oh, this was awful. So, after the new year, I remember, like, Naomi's doing a show at the Pit, and she asked if I could come film it for something. And I go film it, and right before the show starts, I get a call, and I look at it, and it's Nick, and I'm like, uh-oh. I don't know if this does not feel good. For whatever reason, I got, like, it could just be my personality, but, again, self-selecting.
Yeah.
Like, it's neutral. So I go answer the call. I'm in the Pit. No one's in. They haven't let anyone in yet. I'm only in there. I'm in the performance space.
Yeah.
In the theater part. I'm only in there because I'm setting up before Naomi. And she let me come with her into the... I'm trying to explain.
No,
there's no one else here. I pick up the phone. And he's like, hey, Andy. I'm like, hey, Nick. How's it going? We got some good news and bad news. And I'm like, oh. He's like, hey, we got a pickup for a second season, but we can't bring you back because we don't have the budget for it.
Yeah.
Now, here's where I choose to believe him.
Yeah.
Because to bring me onto the first season, he had to ask for extra money because they only had one enough for Chris Thayer. They only had enough money. So he had to actually go to the network for extra money.
Wow.
So I choose to believe him, even though also I felt very out of sorts.
Well, that's a situation where I don't even think it would be helpful to not believe him. Like in the sense of, extracting negative meaning out of something that may not actually have anything to do with you personally, in a sense of, like, yeah.
It's still rejection.
Of course. But, like, in terms of, like, long-term assumptions about yourself.
Yes.
It's, like, not helpful to be, like, he's probably lying to protect me, like, kind of thing. Like,
yeah,
no.
Or just to be nice.
Yeah.
He's a very nice man.
Yeah.
So I could see him, like, wanting to spare my feelings. Like, yeah, we don't think, we don't think your brand of the humor is really... Because I was, like, I did aim towards more absurdist and more political stuff.
Yeah.
Which is not Pete's voice.
Mm-hmm.
So... I could see it also being like not being a fit, but I will choose to, it's probably both. It's probably like,
yeah,
like something like that.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, that ended. So that was at the beginning of this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then in terms of after that, I know you've had some stuff up on like Adult Swim and things like that, right? Or like, I had looked you up.
Oh, AdultSwim.com.
Yeah. Yes, for a while.
That was before, like, Joe Randazzo and Kelly Hudson and those people were there was Thing X that got absorbed into... Thing X was the old Onion writers that didn't want to move to Chicago when the Onion moved to Chicago. That got absorbed and turned into Adult Swim. But this was right before that. They gave Mike Sachs... he's the humor writer for... and he did Poking a Dead Frog as his new one.
Okay.
And here's the kicker.
Yeah.
That book, Fantastic Interviews, that I mentioned at the very beginning of this. He was the editor of AdultSwim.com for 3 months.
Yeah.
And he asked me and my, again, my writing partner at the time, Mark, yeah. to write for him.
Wow, nice.
Yes. So we wrote stuff for that.
That's awesome. So how was that process? Because I remember you saying when you pitched to Above Average, they said your voice was more like Adult Swim. Did you find that to be true? And like,
I don't want to tell Mike's story because I don't know how much he wants to.
Sure.
It's his, and I don't know how much it's public, but it was difficult because yeah. AdultSwim.com is not the same thing. Mm. Right before he took over, it was like interviews with porn stars about like what video games they played.
Oh, good. Okay.
And things like that, which that's all right. If that's what you want to do. I mean, there's nothing, I'm not like looking down on porn stars.
Yeah.
But I'm looking down as like, that's the level. If I talked to a porn star, I'd want to like ask her about like what her life is like or what her fears are or, you know, about her as a person. And not just like some superficial thing.
Yeah.
So that's not like, I'm not looking down at her having sex on film for a living. Sure. I'm looking down on that, like, on the, like, what are great. You playing Mario Brothers? What are you doing?
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking down on. So he took over and changed, you know, he's a humor writer.
Yeah.
So he changed it. So we were writing humor pieces and we were writing interviews. I got to do this. I pitched some stuff that eventually became segments on Beginnings.
Nice.
I got to talk to, Kurt. I mean, I knew Kurt Braunohler, so that wasn't a stretch. By the way, that's not. I realize that's not a bad. Like he's nobody.
No, I specifically went to the Beginnings one where he was there.
Kurt and
I think
Kristen,
he's great.
Like, were some of the people that gave me hope that there is room for weird voices.
Penelope,
comedy.
Princess of Pets is the weirdest. Yes.
Did you see Hot Tub when they were doing Hot Tub at UCB?
No, I saw them do a Hot Tub at the Eugene Merman Festival a couple of years ago.
They did Hot Tub. They were doing it at UCB when I first was taking classes there.
Yeah.
And it was like, I said this to Kurt, I think when he was on Beginnings the first time, but like, I was like, it meant a lot to see you because to see that there are spaces for people who have the same voice that I do. So I don't want that to come off as denigrating him, but now I can't remember his name, the showrunner of Community. And
oh, Dan Harmon.
Dan Harmon. I got to speak to Dan Harmon through this stuff.
Nice.
So people who I have no connection to. So yes, so there's stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I got to do that kind of stuff.
That's awesome.
For Mike, which is awesome.
That's very cool. And you also, so since Pete Holmes ended, what have you been up to?
Hustling.
Yeah.
This is the first year. So this is where I was talking about that, like being okay with chaos.
Yeah.
Cause this is the first year where I'm just like, all right, I have a little bit of economic space.
Mm-hmm.
We have, Naomi and I have like pared down our lifestyle. Neither of us come from wealth in any way. We come from middle class to, I think maybe even in her case, lower middle class backgrounds. Yeah. We don't have like, it's not like we can go to our parents. Our parents, by the way, our parents will help us if we like are desperate. So I'm not trying to say that we have no safety net.
Sure.
Because I feel like this economic stuff is really important because a lot of the people that I see succeeding, they come from very comfortable economic backgrounds. And so it's okay for them to take a risk because their parents are still paying for stuff.
Yes.
Or, you know, I can fail because my parents can pay my rent for the next month or two.
Yes.
So my parents have been, and Naomi's mom has been very helpful.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to paint that picture, but it's awesome. But they can't pay my rent. They can't. There's lots of stuff that can't, like if I can't pay my rent, we're fucked in a certain sense.
Yeah.
So this is the first year we've been just like hustling for like we're both of us. Like Naomi wrote for Broad City, so that was nice. I still had a little bit of Pete Holmes money I'm living off of. And we've just been like, you know, Naomi goes on auditions and I had some writing jobs. I did a Victoria's Secret commercial a month ago.
Oh my God.
Which was really fun. I wrote that for that reality show on CW.
Yes.
And, so little things like that. I was on unemployment for a while. So it's, again, like, it's not like, you know, and we're both like, whatever jobs we can take right now.
Yeah.
Just so we don't have to go back to a full-time day job.
And in terms of that, like, are you reaching out for these freelance positions or are people approaching you? Like, what is your methodology now that you are freelance and, like...
Both. Okay. You gotta do both.
Yeah.
So, the CW thing came from this... I felt good because this was the first time I was recommended for something, just outright. Yeah. So, a writer friend of mine who's, like, real... Like, has made his living on writing for a decade or more... knows my stuff because he asked me to pitch. He's asked me to pitch him some stuff before, so I've helped him on things and pitched him jokes and stuff like that, and done punch up for him. He recommended me for this. The producer asked me to write some spec jokes. I did. They used them on the show, and got again. I feel like I'm not trying to be arrogant, but they got the best laugh. I watched the dailies.
I had a teacher once that said, "Pride is based on good work. Arrogance is based on bullshit."
Here's the fear. This is a real fear of mine. I've seen it slide. I've seen this. It's a slippery slope between someone taking pride in their stuff and then just being arrogant about it. And I'm very wary because I don't want to turn into a shithead. And I can see how it could be possible. It's not like it's that far off. I have the arrogance. I have all the things that could let me become a shithead. So I'm always on. I'm always on watch.
Yeah.
But the jokes did the best. Liked them. The host liked the jokes, so they hired me to do that stuff. And that was the first. But then other things, like I reached out to, I met some writers on Conan because Conan produced the Pete Holmes show and it was right across the street on the WB lot from the Pete Holmes show. And I met some of them and got to be friendly with some of them. I wrote to one guy and I'm like, hey, can I submit a packet to Conan? And he's like, yeah, we're not looking for anyone right now.
Yes.
But, yes, I did, and I'll give it to the head writer.
Yeah.
Again, if you're not an asshole to people.
Yes.
And you do good work yourself.
Yeah.
People are happy to help you. So it's a mix of those things. You also have to, like, let people know that you're looking for work.
Yes.
I talked to Chris Kelly on Beginnings on an upcoming episode, and... He's like, once you, like, become comfortable with asking people for help, like, things get better.
Yeah.
I think that's, like, that is, it's tough.
What do you think prevents people from asking?
Rejection.
Yeah.
I was talking about this in therapy a couple weeks ago, where I called myself, like, a Schrodinger's cat, in the sense that I'm happier not knowing stuff, like emotionally. I'm happier. I would rather not. It took me a long time to write that Conan writer.
Mm.
Or my friend Pete Shearer and I are writing a new show together. And I had the idea months ago and I knew I wanted to work with him.
Yeah.
But I was too scared. He's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
We've been friends for years, but I was too scared to write him for fear that he would say no. And I was happier, like, I'm happier not having an answer. Like, the happiness of not having an answer trumps even the happiness of a yes.
Yeah.
So that kind of Schrodinger's catty in between yes and no, not knowing, is a state of, like, is a stable, happy state.
Mm.
And I think it's, a lot of this stuff, it's not just showbiz. I don't mean to just relegate it to that, but I think a lot of it is an entropy problem.
Yeah.
How much energy do you have? And no's take away energy. You have to get used to no's so that they don't take away energy.
Yes.
And I think that's a lesson, but that you have to just, like, get those no's in so that the no's that happen later on don't tear so much of your energy away from you and don't depress you so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like that. It's that fear of rejection. Nobody wants to be rejected from anything, especially like if your emotions are so close to your surface, then it's like depressing.
Yeah. And I guess, like, how do you think you've started to get over that?
You keep going. Like, it's tough for this to be, this is not advice because I don't think it's, I think, say, if you have depression, this isn't going to help you because it doesn't mean anything. Because when I say you just keep going, you literally just have to keep going and not stop. So you know, if I get bad news about something, we pitched, my friend Rich and I again, we pitched another cartoon to Nickelodeon, and we got really far in the process before they passed on it. Like, there were 300 pitches, we were in the top 10.
Yeah.
And then they picked 4 out of those 10, and we did not, we were not one of them, and the executive we worked with really loved it, and she, like, she's been encouraging us to do other stuff with it.
Yeah.
But it was depressing, especially because I was working with someone at the time on a project on a that CW show. The other guy on that I was writing with, who's really cool, has been writing for a long time here in New York, and I look up to him. His show did get picked up for Nickelodeon. So they were he was going through that at the same time that I got that rejection.
Yep.
And so, like, the next day, it was, like, really depressing. And so I lay in bed in the morning, and then I went and wrote in the afternoon because there's no, like, if you're, again, this, a lot of this stuff is not, it's who you, your, what your personality is.
Yeah.
And how, I mean, there's a certain sense of, like, how can I cultivate it? But if you're driven and it's, like, what you want to do, you won't stop.
Totally. I totally get that.
Like, and feel your feelings.
Yes. That's what actually I was just going to say. Like, it's important and valid that you felt sad and rejected. Totally. It doesn't, it's not mutually exclusive of continuing, though. Like, both can happen.
And probably the stuff you'll write that day is shitty, but, like, fucking write that shitty stuff.
Yeah.
And so you can at least do something with it the next day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is going back super far. Do you, so now that you've, like, grounded yourself in, like, this freelance comedy work, in this freelance lifestyle, do you remember, like, the first comedy thing, writing, video, anything you ever produced ever, whether you were, like, a kid or whether it was, like, you did it in college, whatever?
As a kid, I mean, I wrote sketches. What I'm saying are sketches, but are not anything close to, like, what sketches are. I mean, I've always been doing something. I did, like, a first video was for German class. The assignment was to write and film a soap opera.
Yeah.
And instead, I turned it into, like, a sketch comedy thing. Like, the first part of the soap opera was, like, a sketch of, like, Darth Vader and Luke. No, Luke and Leia on a date.
Yeah.
Darth Vader and Leia on a date. I forget. It was some weird thing.
Yeah.
That ended in a lightsaber battle. And then the second part of it was where I took the characters from the Kids in the Hall sketch about the two insane, it's Dave Foley and why can't I think of his name? He's my favorite, Kevin McDonald.
Kevin McDonald,
as the two clearly insane women.
Oh, okay.
We're sisters! I forget what the name, it's one of my favorite sketches, I can't think of the name of the, but we're sisters, and we're clearly insane!
Yeah.
Them in a different, you know, I took the game, their game, just played it in a different place.
Yeah.
And then the third part of it, and it ended, so you had to, each character in the soap opera had to say 100 words in German. And whenever a character got to 100 words, whatever the third part was, the third part was a sketch, again, these are just sketches, about two men who are talking to this woman, and both of the men are somehow pregnant by the same woman.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't even get how this is possible.
Yeah.
And at every time someone hits 100 words, there's a man in a Native American costume who shoots them with an arrow. And they die. They get shot with an arrow and die. And so that's the end. And she had, the German teacher loved it.
Yeah.
But the next year she created a new rule in the project that the project has to make sense. that it can't be like a weird sketch comedy thing.
Yeah.
But I was writing, like, Weird Al parody songs as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And writing stuff with my friend Lex.
Yeah.
Who's now, like, an executive at the Mid-Roll, which is, they do advertising. They hook up podcasts with advertisers.
Oh, nice.
They, like, I think they're part of Earwolf now, too, in some way.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I'm always interested in that, like, kind of origin story stuff, because I find it so interesting that I feel like, as, like, a kid or, like, a younger person, you judge yourself much less along the way as to, like, what something, a project means in comparison to other things that exist at times. And it's, like, really insane to think that, for me, I'm like, that's the same person, that same person that didn't care at all that this, like, doesn't look super great or whatever. like, now cares so much about, like, each thing.
Yeah, because you, as you age, I think there's this Marxist thing that happens with the things you create in that. So Marx had his theory about the working class mm-hmm. and alienation is that they get alienated because, say, like, you work at a, I don't know, wood plank factory.
Yeah.
So you're making wood planks, but, like, you're putting your labor into that. You're investing this thing you're making with your ego. So when it gets sold and you don't get the profit, you're alienated from this thing because now this part of your ego is out in the world, but you didn't get the benefit from that. Yes. Someone else did. And I think as you progress, as you age, and as you make things that are more meaningful to you too.
Yes.
Like, I think that sketch comedy German video is fun, but, and part, my ego is invested in it, sure.
Yeah.
But now a thing I create, a web series I create, or a snap impression or whatever, my ego is way more invested in that.
Yeah.
And so when that's out in the world, and say, I made this lovely video with my friend Aaron Burdett, who is
he's super funny.
He's
love
awesome.
Him.
We worked together on some stuff, and we made this video that I love called Time Pranks. And we put it out, and it didn't get much of a response. And I still think, you know, it's not like a quick sketch video. It's actually more like a short film.
Yeah.
So I can understand, like, why, and it's not topical. Mm-hmm. There's, like, a ton of reasons why, you know, it got overlooked. Like, I'm not shaking my fists at fate and being like, why is this not viral? Like, I guess I don't really care if something's viral or not. But I do care if, like, people watched and liked it and enjoyed it and stuff like that. So it's like, why? There's a little bit of, like, sorry, you were about to say something.
No, I was just about to say there's this idea of quality versus, like, quantity views of, like, oh, do I care more that, like, 10,000 people watch this, or do I care that the people, the, like, 200 people that watched this really, really liked it and, like, remember it kind of thing.
Well, I don't even know if that happened. I know, like, maybe a couple hundred people at most. Like, I have not paid attention to. Because I have to divorce myself from the result of things.
Of course.
Unless I want to go nuts.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's tough to do.
Yes.
But, Time Pranks, I love it. Like, it really, like, I think there's something really fun and interesting and silly about it. And, yeah, my ego's, like, deeply involved in that.
Yeah.
And, so it will, like, if it isn't a hit, part of that is like, oh, yeah, it wears you a little bit.
It does. But I guess it's like a thing, too, of like, if it's purely like a thing you love, you didn't try to like satisfy someone else's needs by making it. It's like almost like, what else can you do? That's like the most you could possibly do. And not in a defeating way. It's like, that's all I could do. It's like, no, I made a video. I can only make it from my point of view.
That's healthy.
Yeah.
It's that mental component to this, and that being mentally healthy component.
It's huge.
I mean, if it wasn't for therapy, and if it wasn't for, you know, Naomi's a very emotionally open person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before we started dating, I was very repressed, emotionally repressed, and it just comes from, you know, a lot of different reasons that I don't really have to go into. But, you know, being with her, who's like, good with talking about her emotions and therapy and just, you know, getting older and all those things work together to lessen these blows and to make you better. But it is like a process of like transforming yourself into someone who can deal with this stuff.
Totally.
Unless you're like that, like maybe you grew up in chaos and so it's just natural and you feel okay and you feel at home in it. That's cool.
Yeah. No, I think the transforming part's huge because it's an arc. Like one video being put up is not, it is one data point on a larger arc. It is not the whole arc.
But yeah, but like a video that I put up like
5 years
ago, I didn't give a shit how many people watched it. Yeah. Like there is a certain, I don't know. I don't know how, I guess you want an audience. Like I'm not crazy and I'm just like, I'm just doing this for myself. I'm not. I want to affect people emotionally. Either I want to make them laugh or feel something.
Yeah.
So I'm lying if I don't care, but also, that's not the, if I made something just to appease other people, I've tried that before. It turns out shitty.
Yeah. No, totally. And that's what I mean, too, like, with the whole, like, the data point thing is, like, okay, if it doesn't work out, that, like, doesn't mean any, like, you did you. That's all you can do. And all you can do is continue to do you. And, like, that's sort of, like, the arc, I see.
Yeah, and do it better. Learn how to, like, again, listen to your gut.
Exactly.
And the more I've listened to my gut, the better I've been as a comedian.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not the greatest performer because I don't concentrate on that. But I do perform, and the more, you know, I had a class with Gavin Spieler early this year. I love him, period. Yeah. But I can say I killed in that class.
Yeah.
Because I started listening to my gut.
Yeah.
More than I had before.
Yeah.
And just, like, the stuff I've written or performed this year has been better and better. Yeah.
It's all an arc, man. It all is. So I was going to wrap things up. I just want to know if you had any advice for someone that wanted to be a writer, like freelance or staff, whatever, what would you say to them?
You know what the advice I see all the time is, like, just write every day.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's, yeah, you want to write all the time. What's, like, good though? What's a good piece of advice that going to therapy? I mean, that's not for everyone though. I don't know if that really would help you.
I think I think some people are just, like, you're talking personality baseline. Some people are more open to it helping them, and some people just, like, it wouldn't do anything.
Know thyself.
Yeah.
Know who you are as a, listen to yourself. Know that writing, a lot of it isn't writing. Oh, here's one that I think actually will help people, which is, don't occupy yourself. Let yourself be bored. Because a lot of your mental machinery is going to work out details of whatever you're writing.
Yeah.
So I'm really good at narrative. So I concentrate on that. You know, I'm writing pilots and I'm writing mostly narrative stuff these days. And thinking about plot details or thinking about characters and stuff like that, a lot of that's going to happen and your brain's going to parallel process that in the background.
Yeah.
And the answers are going to come out later.
Yeah.
But if you're constantly, there have been periods in the last 5 years where my anxiety has been so severe that I will drown it out by constantly listening to podcasts and constantly watching shows and things like that and not giving my brain space to breathe. And those times were also coincided with when I was producing the shittiest work. Because I'm not giving my brain the space to be bored and think over this stuff, either consciously or unconsciously.
Right.
I paused there for a second. I was like, do I want to say unconsciously? Sure. Again, parallel processing.
Yeah.
That's not, I feel like that's actual science, that your brain processes stuff in the background.
Yes.
I think that's a true thing. So I don't feel like it's pseudo-scientific to say it. But if you don't give yourself that space, you're just going to produce crap.
Mm-hmm.
So I want, like, as someone who does make podcasts, I do want people to listen to my stuff.
Yeah.
But if it's interfering with you actually creating, I would say give yourself some space to be bored and just sit there and stare out the window for an hour and see what happens.
Yeah.
Is that good advice? I don't
know. No, I think it is because
have other people said that?
No, not necessarily, because I think that there's a thing, especially in comedy and performing, of, like, you got to be on the grind, you know? Every night you got to be doing shows. Every night you got to be at an open mic or writing something or doing something. There's, like, a level of, like, really, like, I don't know. I feel this in, like, the comedy world of, like, oh, I didn't get home till, like, midnight last night because I had two shows, like, kind of thing. And this, like, constantly producing content mentality of, like, being really productive. And
because you want that. You want
the tangible outcome. Like,
you want the feeling. Like, I remember, I feel like this happens to everyone, at least in the 5 years that I've been doing stuff at and around UCB.
Yeah.
Which is that the students start and you're ravenous to perform and do stuff. And you're performing every night, or you have a practice.
Yes.
Or and it's, like, constant.
Yes.
And between, I was doing improv, I was doing sketch, and all this other stuff. And because you want that feeling. You're it's like it's a dumb metaphor, and I'm sure everyone has said this before, but it's like a drug. You just need that. It's always been like, it's still like, Naomi and I did a show we did that bit together last Monday, and it did really well, and I loved the feeling from it. And it was, or no, I did a show last Monday. It doesn't matter. Whatever happened.
Yes.
Whatever happened last Monday, I did a show. And it went really well.
Yeah.
And I felt good. And yeah, so it's not like you lose that, but it's just like, oh, if I really want to do this professionally, you have to have discipline. You know what it is? Discipline.
Yeah. It's discipline. And it's like, you have to do what you want. Like the reason that, you can be hyper productive and not necessarily self-destruct in a sense, is if you're always like doing what you want and not just like being like, oh, well, everyone else is doing 100 shows a night. I should be doing that.
Yep.
Like that's when it's shitty and stupid. Like everyone else is putting up videos for web series.
Because it's tough.
Yeah.
You know what? It's really, it's again, that difficult thing of like, even more so than like that compare and despair, there's a pull, and this isn't me, I don't know if it's in you, but of like, I want to be part of the group.
Yeah.
I remember this very vividly. I did a spank for a musical that Mark, my old writing partner, and I wrote back in 2010, and we were paired with Brian Glidewell's show. And so everyone came out to see Brian's show.
Yeah.
And they also loved our show.
Yeah.
And it felt so good to get the approval of the people that I looked up to.
Yes.
You know, these like, oh, these Harold team members, they love the thing I wrote. Oh my God, it felt so good. I felt like I was part of the group.
Yeah.
I felt like I finally, you know, it was so good. But that's a trap in a certain sense. Yeah, you do want to be part of the group because these are nice people.
Yes.
Some of my best friends I've met through doing comedy and through being part of the UCB community.
Yes.
And it speaks, like UCB specifically, I think their approach speaks to me in a way that the other theaters, like I'm not decrying either Magnet or The Pit, but just their approach and the energy there speaks to me in a way that it doesn't, that the other two theaters don't. So it's not that, but just like, so I want to like be part of that community and get everyone's approval and be there and be the guy that they think of.
Yep.
Oh, I want to film something. Oh, I want Andy to be in this. I want to be that person. But it's a trap to... Yeah, do that for your first year or two, you know, figure out what you want to do, but like, don't get caught up in it because you're going to let the social stuff, and yeah, every story I've told, there's been a social component that's gotten me this thing. Mm-hmm. People that I've met and been friendly with in a non-cynical way, but to have that overtake, and you also like, you become older, like I'm engaged. I want to spend time with Naomi.
Yeah.
At home.
Yeah.
With just the two of us. I don't want to always be out at something.
Yeah.
And so if you're 22 and you're not attached to anyone, yeah, go do a show every night.
Yeah.
Like this is advice for as you get into your later 20s.
Yeah.
And early 30s. But yeah, don't let the social component be the thing, like, because everyone's all needy and stuff. So, like, don't let that neediness rule your life.
Yeah, definitely.
Was that too long?
No, absolutely not. No, I think that's all very, very true and very hard to, like, keep sight of when you are looking for approval in the community. Because you have to realize you are just as important with or without their approval. Like, if you're doing something you want, if you, like, put up a spank that you like.
Ish. You know, I still, like... some famous comedian follows me on Twitter.
Oh, of course.
It's still a thrill.
It's the same thing where, like, you're allowed to feel that sense of rejection or whatever, but, like, you keep going. In the same way where if you get the nice thing, if the comedian follows you, you don't then just be like, I have to curate my tweets. Like,
well,
only...
there's a little bit of that.
There totally is. There totally is. But it can't, like, suck the life out of you. It can't, like, suck your... The essence of your Twitter.
Sometimes I hate doing comedy in 2014.
Yes.
What's your brand?
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, it can't suck the point of view out of you, you know? That same thing of, like...
Yes.
You know?
You know what? I am a little more careful about what I tweet. And, like, if I don't really think it's funny, I don't tweet it.
Yeah.
Like, which is maybe a good instinct.
And that could be actually you just honing your voice, not necessarily like, because if you don't like it, that's the thing. If it's you like it and are like, oh, but I don't know, like that's when it's like maybe not as great. But like if you legitimately don't like it, that's just like a voice thing.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you have anything else you wanted to mention?
Try to be emotionally healthy. Want to be part of the group, but don't let it rule your life. It's good, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I think that's, I hope, yeah, emotions. Pay attention to your emotions. Pay attention to your gut. I'm just repeating myself now.
No, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for doing this, Andy. This was awesome.
Thank you.
Of course. For having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the Little Steps podcast. If you like what you heard, subscribe to us on iTunes. I'm saying us, even though it is just me in my room. And if you want to see more of my stuff, check out my Tumblr at spacejam.tumblr.com or my Twitter at Rekha L. Shankar. Thanks so much for listening. See you later. Big and bright, it's supernatural delight. Every border was dancing in the moonlight. Everybody here is out of sight, but they don't bark and they don't bite. They keep things loose, they keep things alive.